Welcome back to another episode of the Midwest Monsters Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Grizzly Adler, and I'm joined by
Professor Wagstaff,
Venomous Vinny.
Folks, it is a bit of a celebration here at Abner Manor.
Celebration!
It's a celebration! This is our 250th episode.
Do it. Killing inside.
Venomous gave us permission to do that tonight. So here we are, 250th episode. What a ride it's been.
That's a lot of episodes. That's a lot of years for a podcast with no sponsorships.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so.
Yeah.
It's a labor of love. We do it because we enjoy it. And
We pay for the the hosting fee ourselves.
Yep.
Just because we want to do it.
Yep.
Yeah, we got no sponsorships, no ads. Just doing this out of love for the genre and the folks who have the misfortune of listening to us.
Yeah, and thanks for listening.
Always.
I'll be honest with you guys, we'd probably be doing it if you weren't listening. But especially recently, we have taken note of the amount of downloads that we do get and have been pleasantly surprised by that, and I have been surprised that there are people out of the country who listen to us, and it kind of amazes me, and I know it does the other guys, that somebody's taken an hour out of their day to listen to three nerds in Indiana talk about horror movies. Yeah. We're glad you're listening. Thanks for listening.
Shout out to all the listeners.
Yeah,
especially
for sure.
Shout out to the international listeners.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's really fun to think that all around the world we've got people in different countries that are either during their commute or while they're at work or at home are choosing to lend their ears to our absolute bullshit.
And in some cases, it's one person in that country who did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you.
All around the world, the same song, as Digital Underground once said. So.
With that said, Tupac, go ahead and rock.
Great reference to Nothing But Trouble, which we need to cover on the podcast someday.
That Kane Hodder was one of the babies.
Are you serious?
Yep.
Little Devil and
yep.
Bobo.
Yep.
Yeah.
One of those is Kane Hodder.
That's awesome.
There's your tie-in.
Whoop, whoop.
Pick it soon.
Okay.
Damn
it. Well, that said, usually around milestones, we revisit something from the past. And coincidentally, we are revisiting a franchise from our 50th episode.
Yeah, it's a perfect selection. I think Vinny was the one that landed on this.
I was. We were setting up dates of when we were going to record next and trying to figure out what we were going to do. And I said, I happened to notice it looks like 250 is coming up. Do we want to do anything special? And you guys threw it to me and said, is there anything you want to do? And
Worst mistake. We've ever
made. I just looked at the old episodes and I saw episode, I didn't pay attention to what number it was, but I saw Psycho franchise. And then I realized that was a milestone episode. That was episode 50.
It's wild.
200 episodes ago.
And it was fun to go back and listen to that because we're celebrating episode 50.
Yeah.
And you think now we've got over a decade of doing this, which it's a blast. I mean, but this was the perfect choice. And also because I just want to say right up front, one of the greatest discoveries via this podcast is this franchise.
Sure.
And so this is an excellent choice for 250. And if listeners haven't caught on, the hosting stops with 200 episodes. So as we kind of move closer, it's we're removing those those early episodes. And so we're getting this in literally at the perfect time. Yeah. We're keeping Norman on our feed with the 200 mark because after this, once it gets published, 50's gone.
Wow.
Now, we've got ways that we can take a look at archiving those because I think maybe on the blog they may disappear if they're not being hosted on Podbean, but that's a conversation
for later. In some cases, we've done you a favor.
Yeah, some of the early ones quality
just wasn't as good back then.
And that's another thing. I went back and listened to episode 50, and the audio quality's quite different.
Yeah.
So we recognize that, too, if you have played catch-up on some of the earlier stuff. It's been an evolving thing for us as well. But, yeah, what a great choice for
episode 250. We're paying for all this ourselves.
Yeah, right. Hey, if you want to hear those old episodes, pitch in. We'll be glad to pay the hosting fee. So, yep. Here we are, Psycho. So, typically when we revisit something, we don't go beat for beat. We don't go big on the plot or the cast, etc., except for notable type stuff. So, we just revisit these movies and talk about them. And so let's start, perhaps, at the beginning with a film called Psycho.
Certainly. One of the most important ever. Psycho was released in 1960, directed by the legendary Alfred Hitchcock. Robert Bloch wrote the novel that this came from. Music by Bernard Herrmann. Joseph Stefano brought the script to the screen. It was starring Anthony Perkins, Janet Leigh, Martin Balsam, and Vera Miles. So I kind of feel like first dibs on each of these movies should go to Vinny.
Yeah.
Since we've already discussed this on the original episode. So we'll weigh in, obviously, again. But
one thing, real quick, that dawned on me as I was watching Psycho 4 is to think about the just the names behind each movie, having it made. So you start with the first one, Hitchcock. Second one, written by, help me out here.
Tom Holland.
Tom Holland, right? So
yeah, it's the one that Vinny ran into on the street from Spider-Man.
Give us your
joke. Yeah, go. My favorite Spider-Man.
Yeah, exactly. So to go from Hitchcock to Tom Holland to then letting Anthony Perkins
direct,
but Holland didn't direct two, he wrote two.
Yes.
And then to go to Mick Garris directing four. I mean, like, because people want to ignore this as a franchise, which was our mistake going into covering this the first time around. Was like, I've seen Psycho 1, why do I need to see any of the sequels? And it's like, because people cared. And not just people cared, good people cared about making these movies. And so
yeah, there's... I spent up until we covered most of this for the podcast. I think I'd seen two because we'd really pushed for this on the podcast. I think specifically me and Chad back then. But every step along the way, when you look at it on paper, it ends up being so much better than it should.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think that's really what's interesting about it. The Omen, to a lesser degree, surprised me when we covered that for the podcast, where I was like, oh, you know, there's a lot more going on here than I would have ever dreamt.
Yeah.
But Psycho is a whole different ballgame. Obviously, we'll get into each entry, but it's if you're listening to this thinking, I've never seen these and I don't give a shit about them, I'm just going to listen to the podcast episode, I encourage you, whether you want to push pause and go watch them or watch them after we've spoiled them for you, you need to watch the movies. There's more going on here than you would ever expect.
More than meets the eye, one might say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Venomous One. Please tell us what you think about the first Psycho film.
I don't remember the first time that I saw it. I just can't pinpoint it for you. It's one of those things that the imagery is, I think, has been ever present in my life. The shower, the strings, all of that. My mom specifically would not shower. She only took baths because of this movie.
Whoa.
What can you say about it? I mean, it's a bona fide classic. You know, we've talked other episodes where we talk about specifically like Atomic Age cinema. And that's in the 50s. When you compare the flavor of those films, and granted, it's not every film made in that decade had the same flavor, but for this to be 1960, this is pretty heavy hitting. Another thing that puts me in the mind of as well is the Twilight Zone hit television in about 1959. And I feel like in my brain, Psycho was to movies what Twilight Zone kind of was for episodic television in a way.
Sure.
It's just so different. And my brain relates the two of them for some reason. I don't know if that's it's fair. The feel. I don't know what
very,
it is. The,
very important kind of mile markers.
Yeah.
For both. And I have to keep reminding myself, too, that like when I start to feel like I'm regurgitating something I may have said on the original episode, I'm like, oh, that won't exist. People won't be listening to that. They'll right. be listening to this. So I want to point out that frequently with Psycho, in terms of movies, there is a huge portion of people who view everything before and after Psycho. It is the ultimate yeah. marker of change, because Psycho not only pushed the boundaries of what you saw visually, it also pushed the boundaries of what we did with the narrative and structurally speaking. It was just so much. It was so much for viewers. It just pushed so far ahead. It was extreme. It was intense. It was visceral with its presentation and what it did with it. So, I mean, like,
even flirting with nudity.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And I know I referenced it on the old episode. It's the first time a toilet shown on screen.
And I mean, flushed.
Yeah. There's just these one after another. And to be perfectly honest, anybody who knows anything about Hitchcock would agree this ruined his career. Now, there's still success, but he put his name on this. Everything he had, he couldn't get the full funding he needed for this. He put his livelihood in on this, and he never fully recovered. The Birds was successful. Frenzy, Family Plot, his last movie, there was some success there. But when you look at what had led up to this with his movies and his great run, Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, mm-hmm. these... I mean, it's like some of the greatest stretch of filmmaking ever made. Mm-hmm. And this effectively really started to bury him with the studio system, because they're like, what is this guy doing? I mean, it pushed the boundaries on it. I don't know how much we're going to go beat for beat with the plot, but what they did with Janet Leigh was not normal. It was shocking, not only in what we saw on screen, but narratively.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to think about the success that he had, and then you show up to the theater and you watch this movie that's unlike anything that's ever been made. That's crazy.
Yeah. And they were very strict. They wouldn't let people in late. There was this whole hubbub around yeah. with the theater experience. Yeah. Like, don't tell people what you've seen. Don't right. spoil it. And they wouldn't let people in once the movie had started.
Yeah.
That, like, there was just this whole thing about the experience. Go, let it take over for you, and then don't ruin it for people afterwards.
Right.
And so it generated this whole huge hubbub with people going to make sure they got in and see it quickly before, because they knew there was more to it than what just the trailers were showing them. And so it was just this whole experience. There's been nothing like it since.
Something that I noticed this time around... And it's fairly obvious, but I don't know why it stuck out to me this time around, is I really liked, there's the voiceover while Janet Leigh is driving
mm-hmm.
that is a brilliant way to move the plot forward
yep.
and fill in the blanks and loose ends from the previous scenes to get you to the next place without having to shoot scenes and draw out the runtime. I found that to be genius this time around. I was like, what a smart way to get all of that out of the way to get you to this next scene quickly.
Yeah.
Obviously, Perkins is great in this movie. He plays that mild-mannered... the only other person I can say that I ever have seen a performance that was that convincing was Christopher Reeve playing a dopey Clark Kent in the Superman movies. It felt very genuine and pure and innocent. This is a movie where I think, even if you haven't seen it, you already know the ending. You already know what the movie's about. And I don't think that hurts the viewing experience.
Yeah.
I think that this movie is still just as good, even if you know what the twist is. Man, what can you say about Psycho that hasn't already been said a thousand right. times, honestly? Right. But it's an enjoyable watch every time. And I feel like I catch a little something different every time I watch it. And that's not like I'm watching it several times a year or anything. I revisit it every few years. But something else, something new always sticks out to me about it. But yeah, it's just a great film. It's a masterpiece. It really is. And also, for horror, like we said, there's before Psycho and after Psycho, because people were used to the movie theater of horror movies being gothic monsters, spacemen, whatever the fuck it is. This was a guy. This was a guy running a motel in a small town. I don't know.
And as I said on a previous podcast recently, I am always a fan of a movie that makes you afraid of X.
Yeah.
Like, I think the last thing I brought up was Hostel. It hasn't aged the greatest. It's a great movie, but I always appreciate that it will make you irrationally afraid of international travel
sure.
or staying at a hostel. Jaws made you afraid to go in the water.
Very basic concepts that when you watch them, you go, I can't believe somebody didn't do this earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Psycho makes you afraid to stay at the small town motel, afraid to get in the shower by yourself. Like, I
afraid just, that somebody's watching you.
Yeah.
Especially in the day of the Airbnb.
Oh, my God. Never stayed in one. Never will.
I've stayed in one. Had great experiences.
Do you want me to go through a quick idea of the movie?
Sure.
Yeah.
So with Psycho, we open with Marion Crane, played by Janet Leigh. She's in a basically secret relationship with Sam Loomis. Nod to the name that would further be used in Halloween there. She steals money from work. She flees, and we kind of chart along the way. She is pulling over roadside to sleep. She's getting pulled over by the state trooper in the morning. Or not pulled over, but just coming up, knocking on the window. Given her grief, he's following her to a car lot where she's switching cars. She's got all this cash with her that she was supposed to drop off for her job. That
40
she's
grand. Taking.
Yeah. And then,
which was $2 million in 1960.
Hey, I'd tell you right now, I'd steal 40 grand.
Yeah, and we get our famous Hitchcock in-screen cameo crossing the crosswalk there, much like you'll get in Pulp Fiction later. But we get her landing at Bates Motel. It's dumping down rain on her journey to California, and she ends up staying there. And having dinner with Norman, who is the young, very wholesome American guy
even
running the hotel.
Sandwiches and milk. Yeah, is sandwiches, what the officer. Like, sandwiches how much and milk. More apple pie can yeah. you get?
Sandwiches and milk, it's not much.
Not much.
But they have the meal. They talk about the taxidermy he's got on the wall that he's into. And then once they part ways, she goes to shower. There is an original cut of the movie that has become available here in the States that actually shows a little bit more, which is kind of startling because I think she's still covered, but it basically shows Janet Leigh topless getting out of her gown there. But he peeps through the window. And to me, in my mind, this is where modern cinema kicks in. And I'm not trying to be dramatic here. It's even the way it's photographed on his eye. Looking through the wall, it just looks different than movies had looked up until then.
Yeah.
And so he's spying on her, which then leads to the famous scene, the very vulnerable nature of being in the shower and unaware of your surroundings. And it's that great scene where the door swings open and the figure comes in, and we then have the amazingly edited scene with her being stabbed in the shower.
It really is. I mean, that's got to be something that's shown to film students, right? Like, as far as editing goes, like, that whole scene is incredible.
And pardon the phrasing, but the amount of cuts is just remarkable.
Yes.
Shocking.
And it's what makes it so good, because you never see a blade go into anything.
Nope.
If you actually pay attention to the scene, there's never any actual gore. There's blood going into the drain.
But no gore.
But then you have the attack and then the stillness of death.
Yeah.
And you've got her laying on the floor with her eyes open. Nobody'd seen anything
even
like this.
Even before that, this time, that kind of caught me more. That look in her eye of realizing she's dying. You can there's nothing spoken, but you can just tell there's that look of realizing what's happened to you, realizing you're going to die, trying to get out.
It's still terrifying.
Yeah.
It's so good. Then Norman comes in with the cleanup. Mother, what have you done? Then our next segment is Marion's sister, Lila Crane, and the boyfriend, Sam Loomis, starting to look into it. They get with the private investigator, Arbogast, who is looking into the money being gone from the job, and he gets a little too close. Then we have the famous scene with him as he's ventured into the home, where he is going backwards down the steps as he's being stabbed. And while it looks unrealistic, it's still really good.
Yeah.
It looks unrealistic, but it's very stylized, which is why you get away with it.
Yeah, it's still really
cool. And it looks really cool.
But you have Lila and Sam looking further into this. They end up at the local sheriff's house. The sheriff's like, you know, Norman doesn't have a mother there that you think you've heard about or seen. We helped bury her.
Yeah, that scene where they're like, Mrs. Bates, like, what, did Norman take on a wife?
Yeah,
because and then you're slowly just a couple comments here and there till you get to the point where like, no, his mother's dead. We buried her, man.
Yeah, because the sheriff's wife's like, I helped him pick out the dress, periwinkle blue. And so we then end up with Sam Loomis and Norman interacting, which turns into a struggle while Lila goes up to the house. And then we get to the famous reveal where we realize Norman's mother is actually his mother, who's been dead for quite a while.
She gone.
And is down in the basement with the famous scene where the light bulb gets knocked and swinging. And then Norman comes in dressed as mother. And clearly Norman has been repressing any feelings he has, which is why when he's spying through the wall, the sexual gratification from that then turns into mother punishing for it. But we have the very informative and spelled out closing with the detective explaining to the group in the room why. That hasn't aged the best, but in fairness to it, this was not understood back then.
Right.
This really informed audiences because the only thing you'd had relatively close to this, mind you, serial killers, the term didn't exist yet. This wasn't part of, you know, the lexicon. People weren't interested in this stuff. This was a foreign, scary idea in this movie. You'd had Ed Gein in the national news, which is what helped inspire some of the writing very recently. With this. Yeah, and so that helped push part of what's going on here. But this wasn't something people fully understood. And so that is a really informative finish to say, you've been scared, let us scare you even more with some genesis on what occurred here. And so I want to point out that that seems a little tired when you watch it now as a modern audience, but there was a purpose to that. But Stone Cold classic, and it's still wildly entertaining. It's the quickest 110 minutes you'll ever have.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like that long.
No.
It feels like 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Like and Wolf Cop, another Wolf Cop, 80 minutes felt like 2 hours.
Well, and yeah, it's this idea that not only had an audience never, a general audience, all right, let's put it that way, a general audience had never seen that sort of violence on screen, they also hadn't had any concept of a thing like Norman Bates pretending to be mother.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy for them at the time, you know?
It's psycho.
It is. And so to build on that, my last 2 points, which were points I made in the previous episode, Janet Leigh gets what we would call the Scream treatment when we talk about putting
Drew Barrymore
in all the promotional stuff and then killing her in the first 5 minutes, right? Janet Leigh, big star, putting her in this movie, she's dead in the first 20 minutes?
No, it's longer than that, but okay. Still.
She's not Carrie in the movie.
Right.
Yeah. And so
she was a star at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
She was the draw.
Yeah.
So it was shocking to that kill not her even off. The halfway mark, she's gone.
Yeah. And then the other part is that she has done something wrong, but she's not killed for doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that messes with that still messes with your brain today, but it would have messed with your brain even more back then.
Right.
In that we believe in like a justice killing, but she wasn't killed for what she did.
Well, wrong. And at the same time, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at this point, wasn't she even kind of considering going back?
Yes.
And returning it?
She was conflicted. She kept mulling over, this is might ruin my life. Yeah. I probably shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
And then she gets killed.
And then gets killed.
Unrelated reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's a hell of a movie. Hell of a movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything more to say about?
No, just other than this is one of those ones that is kind of sneaky for me, that it's an all-time favorite and important to me more than I realize along the way. You know, maybe I mentioned this on the original episode, I can't remember, but I had a beach towel of this, wasn't particularly cool with peers, but I used it till it was completely faded. I mean, I it was a part of my childhood. I loved Psycho. Psycho was the first closer to modern horror movie that I was allowed to watch.
Yeah.
Because I started out with the Universal Monsters, and then Psycho is what when I really feel like I'd arrived.
Yeah.
As a kid, I was like, I'm a horror fan. Look at what I've seen here. And so the thing is all these years later, when those credits start and Herman's score comes on and the titles are just flying across the screen, I'm in.
Yeah.
It's such a good movie. I know beat for beat everything that is going to happen. I damn near have the dialogue memorized at this point. It doesn't matter. It's still entertaining. It was such a treat to revisit all of these, but just the minute this one cracked open, I was like, here we go. I love it. Like, boom. I never get tired of Psycho.
All right. Well, there it is. Psycho 1. What would come up next chronologically?
Are we going narratively or release date? Timeline. Shout out to Tommy.
All right, let's just go with release date.
Okay, Psycho 2 was released 1983, directed by Richard Franklin, written by Tom Holland, starring Anthony Perkins, Vera Miles, Meg Tilly, Robert Loggia, Dennis Franz, Oz Perkins, his son as a young Norman.
And director of photography?
Dean Cundey.
The King. Dean Cundey.
Which is funny because I was listening to the old episode and I'm talking about how great he is. And then I'm like, oh, Ryan, almost 10 years ago, you're going to meet him.
Yeah.
And I did. And it was great.
Right.
He was awesome.
Yeah. Just didn't know. He's like one of those things that you start pulling together. And you're like, man, this looks really good. Oh, Dean Cundey did that. And then you start finding out everything that Dean Cundey did. And you're like, this man is the godfather.
Yeah. It's like all the Panavision flair with Carpenter. He directed or did photography for Jurassic Park, like just everything.
Just some guy.
Yeah.
Just some guy.
And he's still so humble, which I know Chad referenced on the original episode. Right. It's true. He can give a shit. He's just like, hey, how's it going?
Yeah, that was fun.
Cool.
Yeah. Psycho 2, Vinny.
So I think I saw this for the first time maybe 10 years ago. I don't think I knew for a long time there were sequels to Psycho. And then when I found out that there was, I wasn't in a particular hurry to watch any of them because I thought 23 years later,
yeah, you thought what everybody else did,
you're going to make a sequel to a bona fide classic. And that's hard too because styles were so completely different in that 23 years of what movies had become. And how they were shot and how they looked. I mean, even just down to the basic of being black and white, the original and the new one being color. What an enormous gamble. And I'm sure that there are people now who are much younger than me who this is the new norm. You get Ghostbusters sequels 30 years later. Yeah, like this happens all the time now.
Yeah. Not back then.
So I was skeptical about watching it, and I will never forget the surprise of watching this movie, not only through it going, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
And then getting further into the movie and being shocked that this is still good.
Yeah.
And then at the end being, holy shit.
Yeah.
This whole movie's really fucking good.
Yeah, by the end, the first time I watched this, which was decades into my life, I remember just shaking. Not really, but it was like, holy shit, this
I couldn't believe it.
This is unbelievably good. And I just want to say right up front, this is the gem of the episode. This is one of the gems of the podcast.
This is the ultimate revelation in almost every host.
Yeah, which I'd seen this before the podcast, but not long before. I'd explored the sequels just when I got on a kick with franchises. And I remember thinking like, oh man. And each step along the way, spoiler alert, they're better than they have any right to be.
Yeah.
Each one of these movies.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
And if I'm being 100% honest, they should probably stop at this one, narratively.
Sure. But on paper, each of the movies, when you look
at them,
they end up being better than they should.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I was stunned by how good this movie is. Getting returning cast like that for Loomis, what was her first name? She's Loomis now.
Yeah, she... Which was just a smart little thing in the script.
You bring back the surviving sister of Janet Leigh's
character. She had ended up marrying Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the last name.
Yeah.
Lila.
And you bring back the same actress. You've got Anthony Perkins is back as Norman.
23 years later.
23,
you got both them back.
23 years later, Norman has been released from the psychiatric hospital. He's cured. He's cured of his psychosis. Therapy has worked. He has been rehabilitated. He is now released back into society. And where else would he go but to the property he owns, back to the house, and back to the motel, which has had the state basically appointed somebody to keep the motel open.
Dennis Franz.
Yeah.
For fans of Dennis Franz, if you watch NYPD Blue, you can see his butt.
We do mention that on... The old episode, old Dennis Franz ass.
And the motel is popular. It's making money
with a certain audience.
But it's a drug sex motel. People go, it's like a by the hour kind of place.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that and then Norman has been given a job at a diner, a roadside diner. One of those ones you'd see like in an old Popeye cartoon from the 30s or 40s.
Absolutely.
That trailer on the side of the highway. Because the people who are working there or own the place believe in second chances for people, which is like this gruff chef. And is it his wife? Is this the head waitress or whatever, owner, his wife or his girlfriend? Sure. There seems to be some sort of relationship, whether it's a long working relationship, whatever. And there's also a young woman who has just started working there recently as well, played by Meg Tilly. And that's our setup. That's our lead-in for Psycho 2. All of which, logical and believable.
Yeah. That's the key to this, is everything is grounded.
Yes.
And it really... It's such a smart movie because it plays on expectations of viewers. Because... You think Psycho sequel to it, let's see where Norman's cooking now. And it's not that at all. We've got things that lead along the way. I don't know how much we want to flesh out the plot, but you go along the way assuming it's him. The right. terrible yeah. things
murders,
that are happening.
Murders start happening. Yeah, he's getting notes at work from Mother, and then when other people go to look, Mother. There's no and note
it's
there.
And it's all leaning into the expectations of the Norman that you know.
And
that's
you,
why it's such a smart movie.
Do you feel like Perkins in this movie playing Norman? Norman is even more a wide-eyed babe in the woods. They play him off to be much more innocent and pure and a stranger in this world. Did you get that vibe as well, that he's a little more, slightly more childlike than he was in the first movie?
Without question, because I feel like he was already a victim of kind of arrested development the first film because of his unhealthy relationship with his mother and where all that had, you know, allegedly, you know, landed on. But I feel like even more so you compound that with time spent in prison
or yes.
institutionalized.
And the world's changed around. Yeah. And I think, but I didn't notice it as much previously, but I noticed it this time around. There's a conscious effort there to by Perkins and probably by the director to make Norman more sympathetic. And as a result, play him a little more childlike and a little more stranger in this world.
Oh, yeah. I completely agree. His performance in this is everything.
Yeah, and it works. Like, yeah. Everything that they're doing works. I feel sorry for Norman Bates. I'm rooting for Norman Bates.
Yeah, and that's the magic of the movie. Because halfway through it, you're like, I'm rooting for a guy who's killed innocent people.
Yeah, because
his performance is so good in what we have going on in this current story.
And if you don't mind me moving along,
sure,
the story.
By all means.
So basically, Norman's hearing mother, he's regressing. He's losing his handle on reality after the years he's spent getting over the psychosis of mother. She's coming back. As it turns out, it is Lila Loomis, who's back around, the sister of Janet Leigh's character, who didn't want him released to begin with. She is fucking with him, but her daughter, it turns out, is the waitress from the diner played by Meg Tilly, who has befriended Norman and been staying with him. She's helping her mother to try to drive Norman mad again so he'll get locked away. So they've been fucking with him and manipulating him. Meg Tilly starts to feel bad about it.
And I want to interject here real quick and point out, this is what I think makes the movie special. Most versions of this movie, that would have been the reveal at the end.
Hmm.
That's not the case, right, with this. We kick this out early, and then we play on the psychology of not only Norman, but Meg Tilly's character.
Yeah.
Because she begins to be conflicted with his rehabilitation, and that he's maybe not the bad person that we're wanting to persecute him as now. Maybe we need to quit doing this. And so there's this interesting trio, mm-hmm, of characters that really start to interact with each other and start to shift alliances. It's such a smart movie.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get this reveal that Norman has been fucked with, and it's not Mother, then killings start happening. That, well, Lila Loomis gets killed.
Right.
So who did that?
With a knife.
In her mouth.
Which is an interesting reflection of when this is made.
Yes.
Because we've got 3 years now of the slasher boom.
Yeah.
And so now we're bringing in the old audience with Psycho. But we're also saying, here, new horror fans.
Yep.
We know what's going on.
It's a nice balance.
And they never lean too heavily into one or the other. It's a tightrope walk that they pull off. It's good. But it's interesting, too, because Norman probably was fine, and they literally shoved him back in.
They drove him nuts.
Yeah. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
That's good.
So,
just needed a cardigan.
So, Norman is now slipped back, and he realizes he's been fucked with.
Yeah.
And he's nuts and has a knife. And Meg Tilly dresses up to try to get through to him because she realizes, fuck, he's gone.
Yeah. We messed up.
She goes and dresses in his mother's, in the wig and the dress he would dress up in his mother, and starts talking to him as if she's mother to try.
Which is weird. That's when I started to get horny.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously. Mine really was just when I saw Norman dress as mother. Not appropriate use of the air horn. Let's just say that. So she's trying to reason with him, which, as mentioned previously, definitely has Friday 2 feels to it.
Yeah.
With Amy Steele trying to reason with Jason.
Mother is talking to you.
So she's got a knife, and Norman's moving in on her. Which,
that's not a knife.
Which, by the way, only at this point, because of Meg Tilly's stature, do I start to see Norman as an imposing figure.
Yes.
Not in the movie before, only in this movie, and only at this point, when he's moving toward her with a purpose, and she's so small in stature, he suddenly looks much bigger. And he's a very lanky individual, too, but it's not, he's not like spaghetti skinny either. He's still fit.
He's 6 foot two.
Yeah. But he never comes off as 6'2". No,
he doesn't. There's only certain, throughout the whole franchise, there are only certain periods or certain scenes where you go, man, that's a tall ass dude. And like, they don't oversell it.
No,
like, just occasionally you're like, whoa.
Yeah. And so as he's moving towards her, he looks gigantic and imposing. Yeah. And she starts stabbing at him with the knife. Several places in the hands, in the torso. And he kills her.
Yeah.
No. The cops come in.
Yes.
Because was it Lila Loomis had tipped him off, or somebody had tipped him off that they had been fucking with him and this and that. So they get to the house and they see Norman stabbed up and her with a knife in her hand dressed as mother. So they just gun her down. And oh, she killed her mother? Her mother's over here dead, stabbed to death. Case closed. Norman, we're so sorry this happened to you. Oh, that's okay. So Norman gets away with murder because he killed Lyle Loomis. Is that the only person he has killed in this movie?
So far.
Dennis Franz. Does he end up dead?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know who killed him.
Good question.
Somebody did.
Yeah.
Well, let's assume it's him.
The teenagers in the basement. I think that was Lila or her daughter. Remember the teenagers trying to bang
out the basement? I have a hard time believing they actually killed anybody. I feel like it's dueling against each other.
Well, this film and the next one both have, like, somebody died. Or did they?
Yeah.
Vibes.
Me personally, I'm from the school of thought that Norman's killed all these
people. Yeah, so Norman's gotten away with murder.
But you're right, it's left open.
Yeah.
Like,
so Norman's gotten away with murder. He's back at the house by himself. Nobody's fucking with him anymore. But Norman gets a phone call. And, oh yes, mother, blah, blah, blah. Well, Norman, the lady from the diner shows up at Norman's house. Lets him know, well, that woman you thought was your mother was actually my sister. I had you very young. I'm actually your mother.
I'm your mother now.
And the moment that just sealed this for me.
Just one movement, like just fluid. He doesn't bat an eye.
Because you see Norman as she sits down, he offers her something to drink, and you see him grab that tin out of the cabinet that was the tea that had the arsenic in it that he had killed his mother with.
Yeah.
And he's looking at her, and you know he's not well, but he puts it back. And they're sitting there together, and when she says it, he stands up, turns around, picks up a shovel and just bashes her goddamn head in.
Yeah.
And that scene
with no musical cues leading up to it, just bam, pew, just
so quick.
Yeah.
It looks so good.
Yeah.
And
it's brutal.
For listeners, viewers who may not realize, that's Virginia Gregg, who is the voice of the original mother. So it's a fun tie in there, which isn't important to the actual sequel. But it's a fun nod. Virginia Gregg was the voice. She did a ton of voice acting. I mean, she's got like hundreds of credits on IMDb. But yeah, Mrs. Spool there that's sitting at the table is actually the voice of Norma Bates from the original movie.
I'd be danged.
So he smacks it one time, but it's brutal.
It looks so real.
Oh, yeah.
And he puts her in mother's old dress and carries her up to bed.
Now he's got her back in bed.
And he's got mother back in the house, talking to him back in bed. He's got mother back.
He needs mother.
And that's it. That's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And like I say, narratively, they probably should have stopped right here with this movie.
Yeah.
Because it's circular. It's fucking perfect.
Yeah.
And it's creepy because Norman Bates is back out there. You're exactly where you were before the first Psycho movie.
What's interesting too about this one is that it actually enriches the first movie.
Yes.
Yes.
Because you would assume that for every reason this is going to be a failure. And then you come out of it going, oh, you've actually given me more layers to Norman.
Yep. Yep.
It's a remarkable accomplishment, mainly to Holland for his writing for this. I mean, every choice is just nailed. This is just unheard of for horror sequels. Nothing like it. There's really nothing to compare it to. 23 years apart.
And to think that Tom Holland had an impossible task.
Oh my God, yes.
Without question.
They're like, hey, buddy, we need you to write an unneeded sequel to one of the greatest horror films of all time.
23 years later.
Yeah. It's insane. That is insane.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas.
Nailed it.
I don't think I have anything else to add. Other than I learned a new term this time around. I think I didn't pay attention the last few times I've watched it. But Loomis is trying to get the cops to arrest Norman. And he says, we've got no corpus delicti. You ever heard that term?
No.
Body of evidence. Mm. So, let that be your vocab word for the week, friends. Corpus delicti. Latin for body of evidence.
Thank you.
Proceed.
On to part 3?
Logically.
I think that's probably where we should go.
Sure. Nothing else?
Nothing else.
Okay. Psycho 3, 1986, directed by Anthony Perkins, starring Anthony Perkins, Diana Scarwood, Jeff Fahey, and want to point out Patsy, one of the partiers, is played by director Kat Shea, who went on to have a pretty good career as a director, but it's not really mentioned with this. She's the one that's in the bathroom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she went on to direct a whole slew of movies.
She related to Bob?
No.
Spelled different?
Maybe. Can't remember.
What about Bobby Boucher? Sorry.
Psycho 3!
Hey!
Hey,
y'all, back again. Psycho 3.
Yeah. I can't do the synopsis for this one. I can do it for 4, but... So, all right. I just want to start from the top here and say that in the original episode, I was unkind to this film.
Uh-huh.
And I liked this film a lot better the second time around.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I want to clarify, too, on the original episode, I said that I had this neck and neck with part 2. I don't feel quite as strongly, but I do think it's still a good movie.
It is.
I don't think it's in the same league with part 2. I think part 2 is masterful, and I think part 3 overachieves. I'll just put it that way.
I was going to say serviceable, but I think overachieves is probably better, because it's not just... I wouldn't call it just okay, but I'm not going to say that it's great.
Yeah, either.
Certainly.
It's good.
So I would say if you start at the top of Psycho, each sequel is a valuable addition to the story that is worth watching, but they gradually decline in quality.
Yes. I agree, but also each movie, including the first, far exceeds what it should be on paper.
Yes, absolutely.
Every single entry of these.
Yeah, so, I agree with that.
So with Psycho 3, we open with a completely unnecessary...
There is no gas! Yeah,
a completely unnecessary opening at a convent with a troubled nun. I'm not even going to drag it out. We basically end up with Diana Scarwood's
character. You're going to miss one of my favorite parts, though.
Okay.
Okay. So they're at the convent. The woman's at the top of the bell tower or whatever, the steeple, getting ready to toss herself down. The other nuns come up to stop her. And then whatever happens accidentally, the nun falls all the way down, hits the ground. And then she pulls her habit off and says, "Hi, I'm Johnny Knoxville. Welcome to Jackass." That's my favorite part.
I would have definitely missed that. You're correct. Part of me wonders, too, if Anthony Perkins being, you know, with his relationship with Hitchcock and Psycho, and his appreciation for film history, if this wasn't pulling a little bit from Vertigo and its finale with the church and the body flying down. But it's completely unnecessary. And it's 100% unnecessary. I said that in the original episode. We don't need to know why she's fleeing.
I 100% agree with that. And I
shave all this shit off. Just have her.
I think a lot of the exact. I totally agree with that, and it leaves her mysterious as well.
Yeah.
I don't need. I understand how this kind of plays into some of your imagery later, but you could get by with that with having her have a rosary in her hand when we meet her as a hitchhiker.
Yeah, Grizz is racing back quickly.
I don't need a background on my hitchhiking nuns.
Exactly. So we have Maureen hitchhiking after that. She is picked up by our character Dwayne, who's on his way to L.A. to follow his dreams of playing music, which is always promising for everybody. Good luck with that.
Especially a guy named Duke.
And then we end up at this place. It's a hotel. It's being ran by a guy named Norman. Norman's got Mrs. Spool upstairs. We were picking back up from part two. He's still into taxidermy. He's having a good time. We also get a little nod for the meal there with him and company. Dwayne and Maureen arrive there and are hired. Or not both of them, but Dwayne is hired to help him around the hotel there.
She strolls up later.
Yeah. And meanwhile, yeah, I completely skipped over.
Yeah, because he starts
to get a move on her.
He gets, well, she's asleep when he does.
Yeah.
it's a little rapey.
Yeah, it's real gross. Because it's storming, they pull over and they sleep, and then he's trying to make
a move. He's trying to feel her up while she's asleep.
And credit to her, she says, I'll go out and risk dying in the desert in the storm, then stay in this car.
To which he says, you could have been coming instead of going.
Yeah, which was little beneath Anthony Perkins.
That was a highlight of Perkins' career.
Dwayne is hired here at Bates Motel. He's going to help around the place. And then we also have a journalist in town, Tracy, who is hounding Norman for his past and what's going on with that. Tracy also meets Dwayne and informs him of Norman's past. Maureen, who was our person from the beginning of the movie, gets ready for her shower there, and Norman spies on Maureen, just like we have back in the original, and he even mimics the shot. Remember, he's directing, so he's even mimicking the shot that Hitchcock had of him staring through the wall there. And then we get into her slitting her wrists, and Norman saving her.
Well, because Norman's actually coming in to murder her.
Yeah.
It's the same scene from Psycho playing out again.
Thing, except
he's watched her in the shower through the same people. He goes in while he thinks she's in the tub shower as mother to kill her. Right. He gets there. Instead, she has slit her own wrists and she is fading. And to her, the outline looks like the Virgin Mary standing there with a crucifix. That's why I say you could have played this these Catholic images with just her having a rosary in her hand while she's hitchhiking, because then people assume, oh, she's Catholic. You didn't need all the nun shit.
Yeah, it's bloated. But we get a nice scene bedside with her where Norman's kindness kind of comforts her troubled situation, and it kind of adds to that layered situation that we have with Norman, which these sequels are really developing, where the original had an element of it, but not much. Because it's a pretty swift-moving film, and where these sequels really start to flesh that out. And I think that's kind of the overlooked greatness of these movies, is that in these entries, we add more to his character. Because I think in most instances, with a franchise like this, it would literally just be cut him up.
Yeah.
And with this, it's more about really looking more into Norman without making that the whole movie. We still get the goods for what we're tuning into, but they kind of sneak that in the back door, these elements of Norman that
they keep giving you.
He's a bad guy, but he's more.
They keep giving you these likable qualities about Norman. And so you're conflicted about how you feel about Norman.
Sure.
Which plays in, I think, to you understanding Norman himself being conflicted.
Yeah, you could have just made these cheap slashers.
Yeah, and that's easily what I admire about all of them, is they all try and do something.
Yeah.
Especially where you're creating a franchise 20 years later. And look at other movies with their sequels during this time period.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that they did show the restraint and the respect to the original property and not just turn it into a cut 'em up slasher is amazing to me.
Yeah. Jeff Fahey. Let's talk about him as an actor.
In the original episode, you said a poor man's Don Johnson.
I stand by it. But I love him. He was in Lost, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Jeff Fahey. I wish he was in more stuff. And he plays a creep really good in this movie.
Yeah.
He is scummy.
If you ever want to figure out how to sit around with lamps...
Yes.
Weird shades of them over your crotch.
That, yeah, Jeff that weird
shade. That is one thing about this movie that I started to notice is we are getting a little bit sleazier with the nudity. It's not like tasteful, artsy nudity. It's just titties for the sake of titties in this movie, which whatever. But it just doesn't feel the same as the original, you will.
Sure.
Not that there wasn't nudity in 2, but it just didn't feel as gratuitous as it is in 3. It just kind of feels out of place. Yeah.
You know who else got upset by nudity? Norman.
It's true.
You're right, though. It does get... Mm-hmm. It starts leaning into it more. So after...
One other thing, real quick.
Okay.
Don't talk.
I'll just fuck myself.
I guess I don't get to talk.
You've been silenced.
So, what about Norman with the poisoned bird feed at the beginning?
Yeah. Of the movie?
Right?
Yeah.
I promise I had a good point.
Is this where it also shows him sitting at the table doing taxidermy while eating peanut butter on crackers?
Yeah. So he's like purposefully poisoning birds just so he can stuff them.
And that's a good way to let you know.
That's a turn.
That's a good way to let you know he's not well.
Yes.
I won't even say it's subtle because, I mean, it's pretty obvious. But, yeah, it seems out of character even for Norman when you see that.
Yeah. That's all I wanted to say. I didn't want to feel like I was phoning it in like the Tim Burton episode. So I did watch this.
That's fine. What that scene reminded me of is, number one, that seems like such a thing that somebody with Norman's build would eat as a snack or a dinner. Just crackers with peanut butter on it. Yeah. That's such a simple thing. It reminded me of my grandmother, who lived by herself for a long time, but her dinners sometimes would just be cocoa and toast.
They call that girl dinner now.
But that's what my grandma would... That would be her dinner. And that reminded me of that in some way. And then you end up seeing later, like, the same crackers and peanut butter are sitting on his table, like, way later.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, he just kind of picks up where he left off every time he goes back to the table.
Norman, need to get you out more.
Yeah.
So after our bedside scene, we've got Dwayne bringing home a date from the bar, and with our weird...
One of the weirdest...
And let's be honest, completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with anything in the narrative.
Does not propel the storyline.
At all. It's just really bizarre, but that's fine. We'll move past it. It results in him throwing the date out of the room. She is completely naked. Then he chucks the clothes out. It's just kind of a really unnecessary, sleazy moment, which... And I understand that we want to lean into Norman and his punishment of any kind of arousal that he has, or anything with sexuality for that matter. And so I get that it serves a purpose, but you could have got there in a different way. It's just kind of, I don't know, it's gross for no reason.
I agree.
But that's fine. He chucks her out. She ends up in a phone booth, which is dated because everybody now watching it's like, what the hell is a phone booth?
What's that?
But it does have a nice screen and a shot here where we ramp it up with her being stabbed in the phone booth, and the movie really takes off from there, both in violence and absurdity. At the same time, we've got the journalist continuing to poke around, and we've got also a rainy homecoming party that we soon arrive at here at Bates Motel, where they are going to be going to this game. But we also end up with... basically Norman coming down and getting involved, where we've got our sober girl Patsy, who is killed on the toilet, one I referenced earlier, who director Kat Shea, where she says, hey, what are you doing in here? It turns into a whole thing We've got Norman out with the body against the back of the building and the partiers going by where he acts like he's just hooking up with this person. There's a level of humor that kind of enters the franchise that hasn't really been there, with the exception of the attack at the end of part two. But, you know, with the pretending like they're hooking up back there, and then we end up with this girl in the ice chest, and then we end up with the sheriff arriving in the daytime, and we're doing stuff where he's grabbing ice out of there.
It's bloody ice. There's no body there. Is it real?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it really starts to shift tonally in a way that the franchise hasn't had until then. I give Perkins credit for doing that as the director and really trying to shift it up a little bit and take a chance. But at the same time, I'm like, are you sure you want to do this? This character that you've got, that you've got these two great movies. Do we really want to start lampooning it in any way?
Yeah.
The character that bothers me the most in this is the news reporter. I'm just so not interested in that character. I don't buy the character as what she is. And there's that part. It also gets
really contrived.
She's really obnoxious.
And Duke is trying to bed her. And it's like, dude, she looks like Mrs. Olsen from Little House on the Prairie. Like, what what are you doing?
Yeah, we've got the sheriff's office starting to investigate the missing girl from the football night, which the thing we're referencing with the ice chest.
And, but then, and also, there's they've shown ads where they're missing person.
Right.
For Mrs. Poole.
Yep.
That Norman had killed, that said she was his mother, that he now has upstairs. We have seen missing posters and photos of her throughout, because that'll tie in to the end.
Yeah, and you also then have Duke, who's been there around the hotel and helping and all that, take mother's corpse to blackmail Norman.
Which seemed very Texas Chainsaw 2, where he's got the corpse on the side of the road chasing the guys in the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, that felt off to me.
Also, like the beginning of Texas Chainsaw 2 with the football fans. And going into the chili cook-off, we've got football fans in this one coming into town.
Yeah.
I thought the same thing a little bit. That scene is super weird.
There's some things I like about it. I like the use of the Woody Woodpecker cartoon and how, like, the sounds of the cartoon kind of emphasize what's happening in the scene. I think that's kind of clever.
Yeah.
But the idea that this guy went and picked up a corpse that he found and carried it downstairs to set it in his hotel room seems not bloody likely to me. And you're also, don't you kind of take the emphasis off of how crazy Norman is by having somebody like that in it as well?
Yeah. Somebody who's acting a little goofier.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a weird scene.
It should have been more like, hey, I know what you got upstairs.
Yeah. Whereas he's like, kiss him the corpse. He's like, Yeah, look what I know about.
I almost got the feeling that he banged that corpse. Like, it was that creepy the way he was playing that scene. He was getting a little too close to it.
I think that's on you.
I don't know, man.
In your dreams.
I think it's on you,
man. I think it's inferred. I think it's inferred he got a little gross with it.
I also like when Norman hits him with the guitar and he goes, watch the guitar.
All I could think of was the Honky Tonk Man when I saw him hit him with that guitar.
I'm a Honky Tonk Man.
We end up taking Duke and Patsy, for that matter, into the swamp. There's that great scene with him coming back to
where he thinks him, Duke's dead.
Yeah, and then him just, you know, he gets him down under. Then we have Maureen and Norman, and their interaction evolve into love. And we end up basically with more of a showdown on the steps. Maureen gets it. Tracy the journalist explains Spool's history, the mother that he thought was his mother.
Maureen's weird fall or flight down the stairs.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is kind of reminiscent of Old Boy in the first movie.
Yep, Arbogast.
Yeah.
Yep. And it results in Norman stabbing the corpse, which is, you know, pretty intense visually. for what it is. And then the sheriff arrests Norman, and we wave goodbye to Norman. His time of freedom is up.
Because the blonde lady, she is told about everything about Norman, but decides, apparently because of her Catholic beliefs, that she can forgive him for what he's done in the past. And they're together, they love each other. And then she takes the fall, dies, Norman loses his shit. There's a pretty scary scene facially with Norman Bates dressed as Mother in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of scary visuals in the last act.
Where it shows that grimace where his lips are completely peeled back and he almost looks like the dried up version of Mother from the first movie that was in the basement. That is a very scary image, and I really like that about it.
There's a lot of faceless visuals, too, with the attacker with the face blacked out. That's really creepy. And that's kudos to Perkins with him directing. There's a lot of stuff that
and
last
so
third.
In this one, they've basically, you alluded to this, that the reporter's like, that was not your mother. She was locked up in an institution.
And let's be honest, it goes way too ridiculous on all that shit. Nobody needs all the this and that.
She killed your father.
Yeah.
Well, his dad died by getting stung to death by bees, didn't he? Like,
yeah.
How did she do that? So
that's my biggest gripe with the movie is the journalist exposition on that. It's like, who cares? Like,
yeah,
all of that.
Boring.
So you end with Norman's... First he gets in and says, I'm finally free. Because he stabbed the mother corpse. And then when he's in
Cut
there...
the head off.
Then when he's up in the car getting ready to get taken back to the institution, he... pulls, because no way would they have found this if they'd have patted him down. He pulls Mother's corpse arm that he has torn off and is patting her hand as he's being driven with that same look on his face that we got at the end of the first movie. But that hand's a little much.
It was stupid.
A little much.
It didn't fit anything.
He had it hidden in his prison pocket.
God.
I was a little too proud of that one.
Yeah, still too proud of it.
You've had that one tucked away.
Hey-o, tucked away.
I had this arm shoved.
It was a dumb ending.
Up my ass.
So, only place you go. Up his ass.
Oh, man. So yeah, Psycho 3. I think it is a step down from 2.
I agree.
And while I don't think it's dramatic... it's still, I think, a bigger step down from 2 to 3 than it was from 1 to 2.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Don't argue with me, I'm right.
I've changed my tune. I like this better than the last time we talked about it. And I still think it's a gradual step down.
Yeah, I still think 2 and 3 are pretty close together.
Part 2 and 3 of a movie that was made 23 years previously. These are pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You hate 3.
Yeah, just a bit. Fascist. Okay, so moving along to... I think the next one's Psycho 4.
You said that like walking a little bit. Psycho 4, The Beginning, released in 1990... it was a TV movie, maybe on Showtime, directed by Mick Garris. We've got Joseph Stefano returning to write this one, starring Anthony Perkins, Henry Thomas, CCH Pounder. No, that's not a band name. Love that's that an name. Actress. And Olivia Hussey.
Is it Hussey or Hussey?
Hussey.
I quit. Did you say Landis was in this?
No, I didn't mention him. But yes, he is in there.
For those of you listening at home, if you've heard of John Landis, he's in this movie too. So,
you just offended Vinny. He's out.
We've got the setup for this one is a radio show where they have a gentleman on the show who has committed matricide. He's killed his mother, and so
I thought that's where you killed your mattress.
250.
Clever. So you've got this guy who killed his mother. You've got the father of his mother, which would be his grandfather, who's there on the show with him. Who?
My daughter was a bitch.
Yeah, right. And then you've got a psychologist who says, no, no, I'm an expert on matricide because I had this case with this guy. And clearly you learn that the guy was Norman Bates. And you have a character calling in to say, you know, that guy sucks. That doctor's full of shit. Let me tell you what really happened. And so it's
because I've done it. I killed my mother.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it's a radio call-in show. It's a drama between and he's going to kill again. And that puts the sense of urgency on it. And so now we have Norman living a new life at a new place, and
he's married.
He's married and everything was fine. Everything was fine. But the agreement was when they got married that they would not have children because Norman hates mothers. And now his wife is pregnant and he's going to kill her because of that. And so it's another psychotic break in the life that could have been normal for Norman. As we've seen time and time again, Norman's just trying to live his normal life and people keep pushing him.
So from what I have gathered, this takes place after 2, yeah. Omits 3. Is this correct?
Sure. I have no idea.
That's what makes no sense. That's what I've heard.
We never address it.
Because, okay. I didn't get that feeling from, like, when I watched it, I was just like, how the fuck they let Norman out again already after the second time? Yeah, we have
this perfect swan song with him being cured of his affliction with the mom and dealing with that through the stabbing of the corpse and then being arrested and being free, and now he's back.
Yeah, now he's out again, and he's married, and I'm like, so I guess I just was like, well, God, they didn't keep him locked up very long, but then as I've heard, no, this omits 3, and this is supposed to take place after 1 or 2.
Yeah, and what would be helpful, and I don't say this very often, a flashback.
Yeah.
Show us the last scene where this story picks up from.
So it's rather ambiguous that way about it. I had not seen this entry before. This is the first time that I've ever watched this one. I think that I thought looking at it that it was like a reboot because of being called Psycho 4.
New Beginning. Because essentially, you could be setting up for a relaunch of the franchise.
Right. So I never paid much attention to it. So I did watch it this time, and timeline is a little wonky for me. That's my first complaint about it. I don't mind the radio. Look, you can go a couple of different ways. You can either go exactly the same old bullshit you've been doing for 3 movies. Not that that was done poorly, but you can do a 4th one just like you did the other 3. You're at the hotel. People start getting picked off. Or you can try something different. And they tried something different.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy for what they did because, and I think Professor may have said this on the episode you guys had done before that, I don't think Norman Bates is going to talk about this.
No.
Over that's on my a radio with this talk whole show. Movie.
So, having re-listened to that episode and re-watched this movie, the only case for defense I want to make, you're not wrong, neither of you are wrong, is it possible that Norman is so upset by his wife now being pregnant that he's going to slip up, but also so upset that this doctor, who is so confident that he cured Norman, is now on this radio show.
That's a good point.
That he'd be willing to make the
case.
That's
a good point. And also,
interesting food for thought, but at the same time, he has a life of dealing with those frustrations by killing people. I just have a hard time believing that he's going to get on live radio and spill guts.
Well, and that
it's an interesting dynamic. I agree.
And the revelation.
the only argument I'll raise is like, think of things that you've seen your older relatives and friends' parents post on Facebook now, because it's new media, that you would not have expected. And so this is new media. And Norman's like, you know what? By God, I'm going to let the world know what I think. I'm not pushing back hard. I'm just thinking of like silly scenarios.
And it's not enough to distract me from the entire movie. It's just something that I kind of did feel was a little out of character for Norman. Now, we don't find out until later that the reason for this relapse or whatever is because she's pregnant.
Yeah.
But doesn't Norman make a reference that he's upset because he doesn't want this seed that's in him, this evil piece of himself that he got from mother, to be passed on to somebody else? Isn't there? Doesn't he say that at some point?
Yeah, it's a throwaway line.
So that's there, and I that's going to be important later for me. But so Norman, they end up figuring out it's Norman Bates on the phone with them, and then Norman tells his wife, No, for my birthday, don't meet me back at the house. Meet me back out at my old abandoned house.
Mom's place.
Yeah, meet me at the mom's abandoned house that caused me all these issues, okay? And so we get there. And before we get to that, maybe I should step back for a second. This movie really is to give you the backstory as to why.
This is what I want to get to.
Yeah.
The present day stuff is so unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like, the whole interesting element of this movie is him recounting what has gotten him there.
What got him
there.
We
don't need any of that. Yeah. It could just be him on the phone saying, we could open the movie with him saying, hey, I went through X number of years being institutionalized. I heard your show. Here's what I went through. And here's how I'm okay today.
Yeah.
And just tell the story about the stuff we didn't know leading up to it. I don't need all of this shit about him now being a father to be soon.
Right.
And needing to kill over that.
Right.
And this and that unraveling him.
Well, and I think you had said it in the previous episode as well, but I agree that this should have been Norman's in prison and is being interviewed with him on a phone with a piece of glass between him and a psychologist or reporter.
Because 90% of this movie, the heart of it is the old stuff.
Yeah.
And we could have done all of that with a much more
compelling
and grounded present-day story. So it's like, while I agree on the semantics of you know what we're talking about here, ultimately it doesn't matter. Like, why this movie is entertaining and the any decent elements that it have are all with Henry Thomas and Hussey in the past. It's cool that we have Perkins back, but he's little to do with this. The stuff with the DJ, it's really pretty goofy. I mean, like, it's fine, but I like all of the old story. That's
but it could have been done better. It could have been done better.
Well, and also, you have a 58-year-old Anthony Perkins who's going to be a father.
Yeah.
Well, there's that, too.
You think he is Tony Randall?
I don't know. I'm not dunking on the movie because I like it. But I just want to point out that all of this present-day stuff with the radio station, it's goofy.
I'm in agreement with you on that. And the other thing for me, and this is just for me, and this is my perception, this is never what my mind pictured Mother to be. I didn't... To me, maybe it's because she's corpsey, the voice that came out, the wig that he wore... I don't expect Mother to be like a busty brunette.
Yeah, some hussy.
Yeah, literally.
I'm sorry.
Hussy.
So that, I mean, not that it's a big deal in any way, shape, or form, but it didn't feel congruent to what
I feel. You don't picture like. Mother to be a total babe.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I will say, though, to give you credit, I agree, and I felt the same thing the first time I watched this, and then when she comes unraveled, I was like, okay.
She plays crazy.
Yeah.
She plays crazy.
Really good.
Really good.
Yeah.
Like when she goes off on Henry Thomas about the stuff with the highway and how he destroyed her body giving birth to him.
Her parts?
Yeah. Shit's good.
Yeah.
She's so believable.
She kills it.
She kills it. Kill her.
Yeah.
I don't like the boyfriend. I know you're not supposed to like the boyfriend, but I just don't like it.
He's extra. I don't like it in their period. Unnecessary extra.
Yeah, I don't like it in their period.
Come on now, Norman. Let's go. Let's
make sure we though. Give him the douche eye.
Yeah. Wonky. So, one eye on Jesus and one eye looking for snakes.
Rattlesnake, that's right. So Norman, like we said, getting back to meet me at my dead mother's place where that caused all my trauma. No biggie. Hell, she shows up. Yeah. And Norman is going to kill her. And she's like, no, don't kill me, Norman. We'll be happy forever. This baby will be loved and we'll be fine. And Norman's like, you know what? You're right. You go outside. I'm going to burn this place down. So I can be free and normal. And then he starts burning it down. I did like him being confronted by all the ghosts in the house of people he had killed through his life. I thought that was kind of neat, getting confronted by them. But then he starts to get kind of trapped in the house. And the point was brought up previously. Why am I supposed to be rooting for Norman Bates?
That's my biggest problem. Is like, fuck by Norman the end Bates. Of it, the whole shift of this is to feel real bad for Norman.
Yeah, fuck Norman Bates.
Which is why I don't get... Why you don't like the Firefly family. You can root for Norman Bates. But
I'm not saying I was rooting for Norman Bates. I'm saying, why are you trying to get me to root for Norman Bates?
You're his biggest fan. Clearly.
And like, even if you're omitting other movies, we've all watched it. Norman Bates sucks. Like, he's a fucking lunatic.
Yeah. He's also killed innocent people.
Yes. Fuck Norman Bates. So, but then Norman escapes the fire. Why not let Norman die with his ghosts and all this other shit? And then, and this is what blows my mind, then you have his wife in tears, led away by the fire department and police or whoever, and then you show her either with a toddler or in the hospital with the newborn baby. There's your psycho, a new beginning. It's the child of Norman Bates. The cycle starts again. But instead, we have Norman Bates escape this fucking fire and getting into an embrace with his wife and, oh, now I'm free and live happily ever after. This movie was a big drop for me. From 3 to 4 was a big drop for me. There's some good stuff in it.
Which I think I said on the original episode. I still stand by that. I think it's definitely a bigger drop from 3 to 4 than 2 to 3.
Absolutely.
But
no mistake.
But again, I still also stand by the sentiment that every movie on paper far exceeds it on screen. Like, this is so much better than it should be. There's so much cornball shit that was written into the script.
I'll still be the exception. I like it. I like the radio show aspect. Well,
I like it too.
I'm not saying you guys don't like it. But I like the radio show aspect just because it would have appealed to an audience at the time. What I really wonder is why, when we get to the end, we don't reveal that the killing was done by an EMT whose son had been killed by Norman earlier in the franchise.
There it is.
New beginning. You know what I'm saying?
You want to buy this chocolate?
And if you look a little closer, the colors on his clothes are a little different.
Mother's hair was brunette in this and not gray.
That's a Friday the 13th part 5 joke, listeners. It's fine. It's not great. I'll tell you that.
No, it's not great, but also, to be fair, this is part 4 in a franchise that never should have happened.
It's still really good
for really good for a part 4 in a franchise that never should have happened.
It's entertaining.
I'll tell you that. So, some high spots I had listed. The house looks phenomenal. Really neat that they went back and put the house in what it should have looked like in its original state.
Right,
with the fresh paint on it.
Yes, with the paint and the
motel looking crisp.
Yes,
and new.
And with the landscaping. Like, I think that was a really good touch.
I do think they were a little lazy on their period dress in this movie.
Yeah, it never really feels
like it never felt like it was in the 50s. Yeah, it absolutely does not.
Okay, well... You like what you like.
Grizz took that personal.
He did too.
I didn't even think about it. So.
guys, his great great aunt was a set designer on this movie. He's mad as hell. She did costuming.
I've got these fashion design nerds on my podcast.
I'm starting to enjoy inappropriate use of the horn.
We did not properly bring up the boner scene.
Yeah.
The one right
intentionally.
Now?
Intentionally.
Yeah, right. But where she... Yeah, like, it's part of the psychosis. I mean, it is.
I didn't talk about it because of how uncomfortable it makes me.
It is.
Plus, I don't want to take my shirt off. It's just, we're having a good time.
But they're rolling around half naked. Yeah, he like
comes in from the rain. And
yeah, she says, don't get in this bed with those wet clothes on.
Yeah, rub some rose petal oil on my legs. And so they're rolling around, and all of a sudden she realizes that he is...
aroused.
Engorged, and...
I like mine better.
That word was so much worse.
And so she immediately puts a dress on him, shoves him in a closet.
Calls him Norma.
Norma, yeah. And Charles says, Manson shit. Now you need to make wee-wee in the closet, because that's all that thing is for, is making wee-wee.
Yeah, I gave him a jar.
Yeah.
To pee in.
Yeah.
Completely. Whatever. He's like, whatever, bitch, I'm having an easier time peeing in this than you would.
Yeah. We also build up the taxidermy background. And then I really think that it's effective, the scenes where he poisons his mother.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. That was in my notes, and I just kind of missed talking about that.
You got lost in the sauce.
Well, just, it teeters on upsetting. It's so effective. Because sure. They really drag it out like you would have with that. It's not the kind of typical Hollywood puke, death, right. Blood, gore, whatever. Yes. They drag it out. I mean, and he has to suffer through it with
them. Well, when they said, how did you kill your mother, to Norman on the radio, and he says, slowly.
Yeah.
So there's like, still some great Perkins, Norman Bates moments in this movie. It's not a wash.
He's not bad either. I just wish we had him in a prison cell teller.
I agree with you.
Sure.
You could have gotten very Hannibal Lecter before Hannibal.
Yeah, we still end up at the same place. It's okay. Sure. The movie's fine. But hindsight. Yeah, you're right. That poisoning scene is brutal. And
it's tough to watch.
They had Garrison and Stefano had the nuts to drag it out.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes it so effective, is you keep going.
Yeah.
You're not going to get off easy. It's going to take a minute.
Yeah. So those are just the last points I wanted to make. So great franchise. Has anyone watched the Bates Motel movie?
I think Vinny has.
I put it on the other night in the background.
Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I put it on.
I have never watched it.
You can find it on. It's on YouTube in its entirety.
I was real tempted because it's sitting at Dave's video right now. The 4-pack.
Uh-huh.
So I've got the 3-pack with 2, 3, and 4, but you can get a 4-pack that's 2, 3, 4 and Bates Motel.
So Bates Motel is a horror comedy, is how it's what it's presented really? As.
Huh.
And Norman never got out. There's this little boy that went through a trauma that was in this institution as well. The doctor who was in charge of his care, played by Robert Picardo, Star Trek Voyager, the doctor, for you McRib, Norman ends up kind of mentoring this boy, but in a very positive way.
Huh.
And so Norman dies. So they have a scene where Norman's taken out of the courthouse and put into the car after his arrest and all this. And it's a lookalike. It's not Perkins. It's somebody who looks similar to Perkins.
Because Perkins was probably...
And when they show these pictures of... they start showing some flashback stuff of pictures of this kid growing up in the institution with Norman... photos with him, and the photos are grainy enough, are just not focused enough, that it kind of looks like Perkins standing there with the kid. So the kid turns like 18 or whatever. Norman has passed away now. The doctor has decided this kid is fit to go out, and the kid says, I don't have anywhere to go. I have nothing. And it turns out that Norman left that kid his estate. So, Lori Petty's in this movie.
Huh.
But after we get about a half hour in, I totally lost interest in it, and I ended up turning it off. I knew it wasn't a must-watch for the show,
yeah.
And it wasn't grabbing me. and I got the feel enough of what it was. Someday maybe I finish it, but I think I was a little fatigued. With the whole thing, and because Perkins wasn't it, and I wasn't just totally into it, I stopped watching it. So from what I watched, it was fine, and it wasn't heavy on the comedy at all. Like okay. As far as I got into it, so I don't know if further into it it gets a little more dark comedy or not. But from what I saw, it did not present itself much as comedy.
Okay. The Psycho remake.
I've said it before on the podcast. It's one of the worst things I've ever watched.
Yeah.
It is literally a shot-for-shot remake.
I watched it once when it came out on video originally, and it's so unnecessary.
We've talked about it with remakes before. There should be a reason. Advancement of technology, yes. Narrative. There's none of that.
Server purpose.
The only thing they add is the sound of Vince Vaughn masturbating, and then we see Ann Hesh's butthole.
Yeah.
Kevin Smith pointed that out.
It's a very famous Kevin Smith line.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll never watch it again.
I halfway thought of I saw it in the theater.
I thought about watching it again for this too.
And my wife says, "Why would you do that to yourself?"
Yeah, I mean, just
get your pressure up.
Yeah. No redemption.
And then last but not least, Bates Motel, the TV show,
superb
masterpiece.
I think I only watched the first season of it.
You got to keep going.
You got to get your life right.
Give the time.
I didn't dislike it.
No. Yeah. Same. Dedicate to it, you'll dig it.
Yeah.
It turns into something special in the last like 2.5 seasons.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And they finish it so good. Like, it's not a disappointing ending. Like, you're like, man, I've taken this journey. They're going to do something stupid at the end. And
it makes the whole property better. Like, you want to go back and watch the movies when you're done with the show. In the way that they tie it up, the psychology is so fleshed out. It's, oh my God, it's so good. It's one of the best modern television series that I can remember.
Yeah, I mean,
Freddie Highmore was really good from what I remember watching it.
He only gets better.
When you talk about things like Sopranos, The Wire, et cetera, I mean, I would put Bates Motel in that top 10, top 15 of that era.
Because they really get into the psychology, and they don't pull any punches. It gets pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's excellent.
Yeah. Man, it's so good. So, watch the Psycho movies, but not the Bates Motel movie or the Psycho remake, and then definitely watch Bates Motel the show. Those are my recommendations for our listeners.
If nothing else, I'm sure most of you have watched the first Psycho. Mm-hmm. If you haven't, obviously correct that. Not just as a horror fan, but as a movie fan, you need to see it. But really, the gem that you need to take from this episode is...
I was talking somebody from work into it this week. I was
they were like,
"There's a two." I was like, "Yeah," and watch it. And they're like, "Really?" I was like, "Yes, watch it."
Yeah. It's an enlightening experience. Like, it's just so much better than it should.
Oh yeah, yeah. I just remember the first time seeing that ending and being like,
"Oh man,
oh my god." Yeah.
That's my thing. When we do these episodes, I always. There's certain movies that I hope that we get people to watch a little bit more, and this is one of them.
Yeah,
I hope agree. People will check it out.
Yep,
I agree. All right, wrapping up our 250th episode of the Midwest Monsters Podcast.
Do it again.
There you go. Revisiting the Psycho franchise. I've been one of your hosts, Grizzly Abner, and I've been joined by
Professor Wagstaff. And this, at this rate, we'll hit the 1,000th episode in our 70s. So hang in there.
Venomous Vinny.
Stay psycho, my friends.